No matter where you are, 'tis the season to be shopping, but if you'd rather be reading or giving the gift thereof, you're going to enjoy this very special edition of the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. They are, as Stephen King once wrote, a uniquely portable magic. The quietest and most constant of friends, the most accessible and wisest of counselors, the most patient of teachers, wrote Charles W. Eliot. And a lot of them focus on or are written about the greatest place we know. This hour, we're talking about books, albeit with a distinctly Texas accent. So get ready to take some notes, because our special edition of the Texas Standard, the book edition, gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this day after Thanksgiving 2019. Hope yours was a happy one. I'm David Brown, and it's so nice of you to join us on this, well, what is a holiday for a lot of folks. I have a hunch I know what you're doing right about now if you've got the day off. Well, besides consuming a little leftover cranberry sauce or something, I'm thinking maybe one or two of you are out and about hitting the stores, perhaps. A lot of sales going on. Well, boy, have you hit the mother lode, because as you probably know, tis the high season for the book industry, and books make excellent gifts. Hint, hint. This hour, we're taking a deep dive into some of our favorites, and we're going to kick it off with some expert advice from one of our go-to experts on everything having to do with books. Joining us now, Clay Smith, literary director of the San Antonio Book Festival. Clay, let's begin with those notable novels from 2019, particularly from Texas authors. What comes up on your list?
Yeah, there's one from East Texas, although the writer, she grew up there, but she lives in L.A. now. She's a screenwriter. Her name's Attica Locke, and the novel is titled Heaven, My Home, and it is the second novel in her series of mysteries set in East Texas. That's called the Highway 59 series.
I love that. Yeah, Highway 59 series.
And it's basically a mystery about white supremacy and race. It stars an African-American Texas Ranger named Darren Matthews. And in the earlier novel, he investigated the Aryan Brotherhood in East Texas. And in this one, the 9-year-old son of a captain in the Aryan Brotherhood goes missing. And his father is in jail for having murdered a black man. And Darren, who again is an African-American Texas Ranger, investigates the missing case of this child.
This is really interesting. I love the plot line there. New York Times has noted this book too, right?
Yeah, they say that, quote, the story has legs, the characters have character, and the dialogue has a wonderful regional tang. But it's Locke's descriptive language that they love the most. So this one is $27. It's for people who have various feelings about East Texas, and who like their fiction that is politically engaged.
What about for those history buffs in our lives? Any suggestions there?
Yeah. It was a great year for that if you're into Texas books. I mean, the one Texas book that towers above all the others this year.
I think I know the one you're going to say.
Yeah. Is Big Wonderful Thing, A History of Texas by Stephen Harrigan. It's a mammoth. It starts in 1528. It ends in the beginning of the 21st century.
It's the size of a telephone book. If you remember old telephone books from New York City or something, it's huge, huge.
It
book.
Is. Yeah. And it's $35. It's priced more like a cookbook or a photography coffee table book. But, you know, the interesting thing, I mean, you mentioned the size of it, but the storytelling in this history is so amazing, because Stephen Harrigan is a novelist. And so he sort of chooses these various and largely idiosyncratic stories from Texas's history and highlights them and puts a spotlight on them in a way that a novelist would. So, you know, if you've read other histories of Texas, this one's, I think, a little bit more generous and even personable. There's first person in this mammoth history of Texas, too.
So this is a nonfiction here.
It is. Yeah. It covers the entire history of the state.
Is there such a thing as a history fiction book or no?
Yeah, there is a novel that has been on the New York Times bestseller list for a while now by Laura Prescott, and she lives in Austin. She is a graduate of the Michener Center for Writers, and the novel is titled The Secrets We Kept, and People may not know this, but when the famous Russian novel Dr. Zhivago was published in 1957, it wasn't published in Russia because the Soviets didn't want it to be published there.
That makes sense, now that I think of it, of course.
So it was taken to Italy. The CIA got a hold of it in Italy. They got it retranslated back into Russian. Then it's a huge novel, and they got it translated and then published in these tiny editions, which they then got into Russia and distributed in Soviet Russia to turn Soviet citizens against their own government.
Wow.
And so Laura Prescott, this is a novel, but it's telling a story about the women in the typing pool at the CIA who contributed to, and in some cases were in charge of, this whole effort. And so those women haven't gotten their due in history, and this novel gives it to them.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. Not much time left, but I wonder if we shouldn't focus on 2020 for just a moment. Maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves, but if you had anything that we should be on the lookout for, anything that come up?
Well, if anyone remembers the intractable bitter breakfast taco wars between Austin and San Antonio a few years ago, which city was made the better ones? Jose Ralat, who is the new taco editor at Texas Monthly, is going to have a book out in April called American Tacos, A History and Guide. And I'm not going to tell you what he says, but he does make a decision about which city wins.
So you're going to hold off on that. Of course, you would, because you're from San Antonio nowadays. And so there's a little bit of a rivalry. Well, we thank you so much, Clay, for stopping up here in the Austin studios to join us once again. Clay Smith is the literary director of the San Antonio Book Festival. Good to see you again, Clay, and thanks so much. Hope you have a great holiday season.
Yeah, happy holidays, dude.
One of the most visible features on the modern Texas landscape is, in one sense at least, not fixed, but dynamic. It's what's happening above us and around us. Experts on climate change have been warning that the Lone Star State can expect more Hurricane Harveys in the future, and this has rekindled an argument about how we address the aftermath of such storms. Do we rebuild in places that are increasingly vulnerable to storms? Gilbert Gaul is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, and a few months ago we spoke with him about the geography of risk, his new book, which deals with the economic impact of climate change and the fairness of a growing financial burden. I asked him about the opening of his book, the use of an aphorism many people may be familiar with. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And what made him think anyone's expecting a different result here? Because people seem content to rebuild no matter the cost.
Oh, there are a lot of people who are expecting a different result. They're in denial about what happens at the coast, despite the fact that in the last two decades, we've had over 20 major hurricanes in the Atlantic and Gulf Coast, and they've caused $723 billion worth of damage, much of which has been rebuilt with federal tax dollars.
So what's happening? You talk about something called disaster capitalism.
So everything has changed. As we have placed $3 trillion worth of property along the Atlantic and Gulf Coast in the last 50 or 60 years, much of it being second homes and vacation homes or beach houses, the expectations have changed. So that people expect that if their home gets knocked down or flooded or wrecked or hit by wind, whatever, in one of these storms, that the government's going to be there to help them. And we've even created a narrative where we've turned our empathy for people in these storms into a huge government entitlement program to rescue us from our own mistakes at the coast. And now it only gets amplified with climate change, with rising sea levels, with bigger, different kinds of storms like Harvey, which was a gigantic rain bomb, as you know, in Houston. So, the costs I write in my book are only going to amplify or escalate in coming decades.
Well, I mean, but let's think about some alternatives. For example, sure. I mean, in a perfect world, you would want to break the cycle. One thing that has been proposed, certainly here in Texas, is something that's been called the Ike Dike, this coastal barrier, right? You're already chuckling. But this is something that both Senator John Cornyn and Senator Ted Cruz and a lot of local politicians are saying this could fight hurricanes over the long term and maybe even the impact to many of those homes along the Texas Gulf Coast.
Yeah, so I write about the Ike Dike in my book, and I've studied the Ike Dike quite a bit. And the fundamental idea of placing a surge gate, a barrier, if you will, or a wall in front of the Houston Ship Channel, whether it's at the coast or farther up the channel or in the bay, to help insulate us from an environmental nightmare by a 25-foot storm surge roaring up the channel and wrecking all those oil refineries and going into the port of Houston. That's not a bad idea. Nobody's exactly arguing against that. But the politicians have taken that and they've expanded the idea wildly to the point that it would cost at least $32 billion to build. It would be funded by federal taxpayers. And they're claiming that it would protect Houston from the kind of damages that occurred in Harvey, which is absolutely wrong. Harvey was a rain bomb. It was one of five 500-year rainstorms that Houston has suffered in the last 5 years. Those things are due to the warming planet and warming atmosphere. That heat gets translated into the ocean, warmer ocean temperatures that get sucked up by these storms that stall out at the coast and then just dump biblical amounts of rain on these places that never should have been built where they were built. The Ike Dike would help the ship channel a lot. It could possibly help the backside of Galveston. If you build a ring levee around the backside of Galveston, which was wrecked in Hurricane Ike in 2008. Mm-hmm. But all these things are going to be hugely expensive. And the fundamental question is, who pays and how do we share those expenses?
The geography of risk, epic storms, rising seas, and the cost of America's coast. The author is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Gilbert Gaul. Mr. Gaul, thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. I wish we had more time.
Happy to do it. Thank you for having me on.
You're listening to a special broadcast of the Texas Standard. We're spending this entire hour looking back at the best in books in 2019 with a distinctly Texas accent, I think it's safe to say. If you're out and about shopping today, well, you might get an idea or two, so you may want to stick around for this special edition of the Texas Standard, which continues right after this.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Business and your money on this special edition of The Standard. Maybe you remember not that long ago the death knell being sounded for book publishing. Wasn't illogical, after all. Just look at what the digital age did to the music industry. But the epitaph for the printed page has proven far too premature. Ebooks are definitely making a mark, but unlike the recording biz, book publishers have managed to harness the power of high tech while keeping their bread and butter alive. Forbes reports publishers in the United States saw nearly $6 billion in net revenue during the first half of 2019 alone. That's an increase of 6.9% compared to 2018. Digital formats accounted for about a quarter of that revenue, and the story doesn't stop there because today marks the start of high season for book sales. Of special note, a big boost in kids and young adult books in the first half of 2019, almost $1 billion in sales right there. After all the fear and worry in the publishing business once upon a time, perhaps we're set to see a happy ending after all.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. She's a nationally known comedian. In 2014, she was the first Latina to create, produce, write, and star in her own network sitcom. And in 2017, she debuted her Netflix special, Lower Classy. Now San Juan, Texas native Cristela Alonzo can add another title to her list of accomplishments. The Texas Standard's Kristen Cabrera recently spoke with Alonzo about her recently released book on the songs that formed and shaped her life. She calls it a mixtape memoir.
After listening to Ice Cube's 1992 hit song, It Was a Good Day, a young Cristela Alonzo's imagination filled with dreams of her own good day. In her new book, Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up, Cristela writes about how this song,
just waking up in the morning, gotta thank God,
and a list of 11 other songs formed and shaped her years.
No barking from the dog, no small, and mama cooked the breakfast with no hug.
I really loved that in each chapter of your book, you titled it a song that was really meaningful to you. And what made you go that way to use that to help you tell your story?
Look, I don't want to shock people, but I'm Latina. Let's start the interview right. I didn't want people looking at me and just thinking that it was going to be a Latino book. So I wanted to come up with a way that could connect everybody. Everybody has a song. Songs, for some reason, are so moving that they can always take you to a place in your life where you just remember something. They're all little bookmarks in your head. And I started thinking, that's the book. Like, how better could I do than actually describe these songs and how they feel to me? And that allows me to talk about my life.
Look, if you had one shot.
You know, for me, I've always treated everything like it's the only chance I'll ever have to do it.
His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy, there's vomit on his sweater already, mom's spaghetti, he's nervous.
The way that I grew up, I always tell people, like, I'm not supposed to live the life that I do. I'm not supposed to have the opportunities that I have. And there's people that want to keep you down because they want to protect you. And it's so weird how they protect you by hurting your feelings.
Yeah.
You know? So for me, Lose Yourself, when I heard it, it really kind of encapsulated everything I felt.
Lose yourself in the music, the moment you own it, you better never let it go. You only get one shot, do not miss your chance to blow.
Look, I struggle really bad with, like, anxiety. Social anxiety. Mm-hmm. I have to suppress it because this dream that I've had since I was a little girl is stronger than the chemistry in my brain that's telling me not to do it. That's how powerful a dream is.
Mm. Late at night when all the world is sleeping, I stay up and think of you.
I want to talk about Selena.
Like, Selena.
I know.
Cause I'm dreaming of you tonight. Till tomorrow, I'll be holding you tight.
I will tell you, a moment of joy that I had was when the MAC makeup came out.
Oh, yeah.
And that makeup line sold out immediately. It flew off the shelves, and that was because she is the legacy of so many Latinas, especially in Texas. She is what we're capable of being, and that's how she influences an entire culture.
Thank you for being a friend.
You call yourself a latchkey kid. That's why pop culture is so important to you. So explain to me a little bit about that. Talk to me about the Golden Girls and what that connection is.
You know, I would come home from school. I'm the youngest. Because my family didn't have a lot of money, my brothers would go work to help contribute. So my friends were TV shows and movies and music that I listened to. And I had to forge these friendships. I had to create these friendships with whatever I had available. But to me, Dorothy's Bornak and Sophia Petrillo were my mom and I.
Mm-hmm.
My mom had grown up in this little like ranch, in a little rancho in Mexico in the middle of nowhere. No electricity, no running water, no anything, like, you know. She would tell stories like Sophia did. If you thought you struggled, she would give you a story 100 times worse where she struggled worse.
Yeah.
You know, so you could never win.
Could you tell me a little bit about your relationship with your mother and the Backstreet Boys?
Ah, she broke my heart. I was living in Los Angeles, and then out of the blue, I get a call from my brother, and he tells me that my mom is on her deathbed. I end up having to go to Texas to say goodbye to her. And when I went there and saw her, she got better. So she told me that she got better because I was there. Like, no pressure, but a hell of a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Like, no big deal, but you saved my life. So if I leave, I kill you. Got it. Like, no big deal. Like, you know. And it's funny because I have said that this mixtape format for the book, you know, when I was thinking of the songs I wanted to write about, I thought of Shape of My Heart. You know, first thing I thought was, really? Like a Backstreet Boys song? Like, this makes no sense. But I was like, you know what? Like, the truth is, that's the song. And the truth, that's where you get to feel emotions, right? So for me, like, the Backstreet Boys Shape of My Heart was one of, if not the most traumatic parts of my life, because the relationship I had with my mom evolved from mother-daughter to daughter-mother. It was a responsibility that I chose because I knew if I hadn't accepted it, I would regret it for the rest of my life. But my mom and I, we had a special bond. It reminds me of this strange, specific relationship that so many people that I grew up with have. The least I could do is give her back the love and attention that she gave me as a child.
That was comedian and author Cristela Alonso. She starts her nationwide stand-up tour, My Affordable Care Act, today to coincide with the release of her book, Music to My Years, a mixtape memoir of growing up and standing up. For the Texas Standard, I'm Kristen Cabrera.
You're listening to a special edition of the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. I believe we can call this a first edition of sorts, since we've never quite focused on books this way before. But that's how we're spending our hour exploring some of the most fascinating reads we've come across this past year, as well as the people behind them. Let me take you back a little further in time. It was almost, well, let's see, 60 years ago. The Food and Drug Administration approved a pill for prescription use by women. It was called Enovid. And the moment would be a watershed in a movement to give women greater control over their own reproductive health. But all these years later, what do we really know about the effect of the pill on mood, personality, or mental health? Such questions are raised in a new book by a TCU professor and researcher. The book is titled This Is Your Brain on Birth Control. Dr. Sarah Hill, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
What a provocative title. I understand that the genesis of the idea for this book came from personal experience?
Yeah, that's correct. I have been a psychologist now for almost 20 years, and I study women, and I study health, and I study relationships, and I've even published research on the effects of women's sex hormones on their brain, but I never put two and two together in terms of the fact that the sex hormones that were in the birth control pills that I was taking for more than a decade of my life would be influencing what my brain was doing, which is sort of a blind spot, I think, for a lot of us. I went off of the birth control pill after being on it for a long time, and I just felt like my world felt a little bit different. I felt a little bit like I woke up from a nap. Everything seemed more bright and colorful, and I felt more alive than I had in a long time, and that sort of got me really interested in what does the pill do to the brain, and why in the world don't I know about it?
Let me ask you something, because I know that a lot of listeners are going to say, well, wait a minute, is she sort of anti-birth control? I know you've probably gotten some pushback there.
Right, yeah, and absolutely not. And there's nothing in the book that's like, you know, telling women that they shouldn't use the pill. I'm having all of the information that I have now, I probably would still go on the pill. It's, you know, just really a matter of giving women all of the information that's out there about the pill and what it does to the brain and how it can influence the way that we think, feel, and behave. So that way we can best troubleshoot our birth control options. And for a lot of us, that's going to mean being on the pill, but just knowing what to look out for. And then for, you know, others of us, it might mean trying something different.
So what have you discovered about how the pill affects the brain? What is known? You mentioned that when you got off the pill, you felt like a different person. So is this affecting uniformly people, women who take the pill in a certain way? Does it affect their anxiety levels or how much they actually like sex or what?
Yeah, so, you know, in terms of what the research shows, there's a lot of research indicating that the pill can have an impact on mood, anxiety, the risk of depression, interest and desire for sex, sexual responsiveness, who we are attracted to, mm-hmm. the nature of the stress response, and I could go on and on. And in terms of like uniformly influencing women in these areas, you know, the research doesn't really suggest that. It seems that women's responses to the pill vary tremendously.
So how is a patient supposed to be able to make an educated decision about whether or not this contraceptive option is appropriate or better than, say, another, if you can't really talk in terms of outcomes like that?
Well, you know, we know what domains of sort of psychological functioning are likely to be influenced by the birth control pill. And that's one of the things that I do in the book is I outline, you know, here's what the research shows in terms of here are some areas of your life that the pill might influence.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's women, because, you know, we aren't at a place yet where science can make great predictions about how each individual woman is going to respond to each pill, I encourage women to keep a journal, to keep note of how they're performing and how they're feeling in each of these different areas that we know that the pill can influence what women brains are doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that way they can work with their doctor to best optimize their options.
Dr. Hill, let me ask you a sort of a tangential question, but one that I think some parents may be asking themselves listening to you talk. There are some kids who are put on the pill because of acne, for example. I wonder what your research is telling us about the wisdom of that sort of prescribing of the birth control pill.
This is one of those areas where I really think that we need to take some like careful consideration, because I think that we can all agree that fertility regulation is a tremendously important issue for women, and it's one that's going to, like, the benefits of which are going to outweigh almost every single cost that I detail in the book. But when we're talking about things like clearing up acne or just sort of, you know, making your periods a little bit less uncomfortable, in some cases it still might be the best option. But just rather that we might want to be a little bit cautious, given especially that, you know, the people who tend to be put on the pill for things related to, for example, like acne, tend to be girls whose brains are still developing.
Mm-hmm.
And there is almost no research about the effects of the birth control pill on the still developing brain. You know, our sex hormones play an important organizational role in the way that our brain develops after puberty. And so when you have a girl who's like, you know, younger than 20, for example, and you put her on the pill, we don't yet know whether or not the hormones in the birth control pill are having any sort of a lasting impact on brain development. And we also know that women who are 19 and younger, they tend to be the ones who are most at risk for some of the really serious mood-related side effects that can come along with
mm-hmm.
the pill, such
mm-hmm.
as depression, anxiety, and even suicide risk. And so I just say, let's be cautious with these girls, and let's really think about whether the benefits outweigh the costs.
I want to mm-hmm. ask you, especially since you mentioned that this is sort of a balancing that everyone needs to make, and that in most cases, the benefits will outweigh the negatives. However, mm-hmm. I know that especially in this highly politicized world, what you're writing about might give ammunition to people who want to turn this political or, frankly, who want to limit access to birth control.
Yeah, no, that's definitely something that I thought about, because it's like so important that women are the ones who are making the decisions about whether they're going to be using the pill and not other people, because this is a very individualized decision. But I just don't think that women should be put into a position where decisions about what their brain is doing and who they are is something that's being made completely by their doctor. I feel like women need to be given the information so that way they have the information that they need to be a co-pilot in the creation of a birth control strategy. Because right now, women oftentimes are at the mercy of their doctors to strategize how they're going to regulate their fertility. And this is something that women should be an active participant in. These are conversations about what their brains are doing. And so this is really all about empowering women and giving them the information that they need. And people who are trying to strip women of their rights are going to take anything that they possibly can. I don't think that anything in my book possibly could, you know, be used as justification to do that. But, you know, sometimes we get surprised by the types of things that people will use. But my hope is that that doesn't happen.
Dr. Sarah Hill is a professor of psychology at TCU, and she is the author of This Is Your Brain on Birth Control, The Surprising Science of Women Hormones and the Law of Unintended Consequences. Professor Hill, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Thanks for joining us for our special edition on the written word, books to be precise. It might be useful at the moment, considering the calendar, to think about some of the books we're talking about this hour as gifts. But when a Texas dad decided he wanted to give a gift to his two kids, he wrote a book, one that's full of reflections on fatherhood and those whispers of wisdom that young people yearn for, like this. Do not worry about accomplishment. Accomplishment will follow where playfulness takes you. Besides, you've already accomplished so much. You've delivered joy to a man who once believed there would be no more. Those are the words of a man who became a father late in life, speaking to his sons in a remarkable memoir of sorts, Dad's Maybe Book, is Austin-based author Tim O'Brien's first book in nearly two decades. Now, many know O'Brien for his powerful award-winning books, including his classic about the Vietnam War, The Things They Carried. What propels his latest is a sense that he's speaking to the future, not the past. Specifically, the older versions of his two boys, Timmy and Tad. I say boys, how much longer?
Well, they'll be boys for a while longer.
Yeah, they're in their teens, right?
Yeah, one is 14, the other 16.
A big part of this is the fact that you sort of had a, and I have to admit, sort of a melancholy sense that you might not be around to see them through a big part of their adulthood.
Yeah, the actuarial odds look pretty grim when I had my kids. I had them at 58. Now I'm 73. And it occurred to me years and years ago when my first son was born that when they began to know me, they'd know an old man, which is life, which is how it happened. But there have been a lot of joys that have accompanied being a father at my age. I doubt I would have been so patient as I am now with the din at bedtime and all the homework coming through the house. That as an older guy, I can now have the patience to endure it all and have some fun during it.
I've heard, I mean, you were so associated with Vietnam for some of your earlier works. I've heard you sort of wanted to get away from that a little bit, no?
I did, yes. I've been called a war writer my entire adult life, essentially. And though it's true I've written about Vietnam, I was not writing about bombs and bullets and military maneuvers and saluting. I was writing about the human heart under stress. And a book called The Things They Carried could just as well be written about your job or any other occupation. You'd start with the things you physically carry, and you'd move into the emotional burdens. So I've always thought of myself as a writer who happened to write about war. And with the new book, I was able to move away from Vietnam, not entirely, but almost entirely, to write about the wars of fatherhood.
Tim, what is it that, I mean, it's not like you haven't been written about as a well-known author. What did you feel was an aspect of your life that you felt like you wanted to communicate to your children? Because part of this, of course, is wanting to give them a sort of a guidance, but at the same time, to let them know the sort of man that their father was or is.
I think the most important part was really my own childhood. It was an unhappy childhood. I had a dad who was an alcoholic. Our house was full of tension from the time I can remember, as a five-year-old up until I left for college. And I've always wished my dad had left for me what I'm trying to leave for my kids in this book, some love letters, just to say I love you, I'm proud of you, I wish you well in your life. I didn't receive that, and I want my own children to receive it, if nothing else, to know they were adored by their father.
Did you consciously make a choice when it came to kids? I mean, early on, when you were in your 40s, for example, were you still thinking, no kids for me?
I was. I've been a man without a child for 58 years. And when I met my wife, Meredith, we nearly broke up over the issue of having children. I said, look, I fear I'm not going to be a great dad. I don't have experience. I'm old.
Did you? But I wonder, too, if that had something to do with your own dad.
It did. It did. I did not want to be a bad father. And I feared I would be. I feared even keeping the children alive. I mean, I really did. How do you keep this little infant breathing? We felt like a pair of rookies who didn't know how to field a ground ball and or a pop fly. And
it's hard not to think about your own experience if you're a father.
Of course.
And you're reading this. But I was thinking about how much I went into this journey of fatherhood wanting to impart something to children, but finding that they're imparting a whole lot to me rather inadvertently.
So much so.
Yeah. And do you feel like you've learned lessons from your kids?
So many. I can tell you one very quick anecdote. Mm-hmm. My wife and I and the two kids were vacationing in southern France. What the kids must have been 6 and 4 years old. And I got a call, international call, from my sister that my mom had died. And I remember going over to the two boys who were playing ping pong at an outdoor ping pong table and telling them. They didn't say much. I didn't say much. And then for the next couple of hours, we just played ping pong on this in this expansive green lawn along the Mediterranean. And a couple of hours later, dusk began to fall and this purple twilight light came down, and we were walking to dinner down a long hill, and I took Timmy's hand and I said to him, are you thinking about Grandma? And Timmy said, no, I'm thinking about you thinking about Grandma. Well, my kid taught me something really important about otherness and empathy. I thought this boy, as a six-year-old, had only his six-year-old thoughts, basketball and ping pong, but he had the empathy to think about what was going on in my head at the death of my mother. And that quality, to have it revalidated and revisited through your own child, is really a learning experience. It's one of many.
Forgive me, I'm having one of those Walter Cronkite moments where you got to remove your glasses. It would seem to me to be a very hard task indeed to write for your kids thinking about the future and thinking about a time when you're not there. How did you get past that emotionalism? Because you have to do it.
I think I got through it by my wife telling me over and over and over and over, you've got to be honest. you're doing this book that's so important to you, and you're going to have to face bad things and face them with whatever courage you can summon. It was hard to write the story I just told you, but it was also hard to write about my own dad and how afraid I was of him.
Right.
And, but boy, am I glad I did it.
Well, what a gift to your kids, and what a gift to a lot of folks who are going to enjoy reading this book. Congratulations.
So. Thanks so much.
I've been speaking with author Tim O'Brien about his new book, Dad's Maybe Book. Great to meet you. Thanks
you
so much
too.
For coming in.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
I am Jody Edgerton, and I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. And we are a group that crafts custom poems on vintage typewriters. You give us a word, an idea, a phrase, something you'd like a poem about, and we will write you a poem on the spot. This poem's a request from listener A.J. Talamantes. Your school librarian. Shelves full of knowledge, information, inspiration. Find your perfect research resource or your beach read for vacation. Stack 'em up and sort 'em, slick the spines with tape and stock 'em. Bring your stack to me at checkout and I'll scan your card and mark 'em. My Dewey Decimal's on point. Tell me what you want to read. Slantin' rhymes at 811, 307's communities. And if you find yourself wondering just what you would fall for, find your revolution revelations down at 974. Oh, you can keep your Google. I'm no technophobe contrarian. But first come share my resources. Your favorite school librarian. I'm Jody Edgerton, and you're on Texas Standard Time.
Support for the Typewriter Radio comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Well, you can find the Typewriter Rodeo here each Friday and anytime on your favorite podcast platform. We're always collecting ideas for poems on social media and at texasstandard.org. It's not every day you get to chat with a Pulitzer Prize winner, but that honor, Pulitzer Prize winner, is just one of Samantha Power's many. You may recall her name as ambassador to the United Nations in the Obama administration. More recently, she's been a professor of global leadership and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, and she's a professor of practice in human rights at Harvard Law. She's also the author of a new memoir, The Education of an Idealist. She told our colleague Laura Rice her many accomplishments weren't exactly mapped out.
I have made every decision in my life pretty impetuously. And actually, I think objectively, most of the decisions I made at the time looked like flawed decisions. The big one that was made for me, which I describe in the book, was coming to this country as an immigrant. Mm. My mother couldn't get a divorce from my father and wanted to run away with another man from Dublin, Ireland. And the best way to do that was to come to America. After I graduated from Yale, I went off and moved to Bosnia during the war there and became a war correspondent. I was a stringer, which meant, you know, I didn't have health insurance or anything. But by the end, I was writing for The Washington Post, The Economist, and what would have been my dream publications. And yet I felt a kind of hollowness, like I was a bit of a voyeur, you know, going into families and saying, what just happened to your child, and not being able to do anything about it. And so I left and I went to law school. But then I dropped out of law school. I wanted to put the Bosnia experience in context and look at American responses to the major genocides of the 20th century. 5 years later, I finally finished what became a book called A Problem from Hell. And then a first-term senator, Barack Obama, read the book and we got together. And I tell that story in the book of how I ended up going and working for him.
Yeah.
And I, when young people say, I want to be U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, or, you know, I caution them against that kind of titular approach. You know, when you assess whatever's before you, can you think instead, will I grow? Will I learn? If the worst that happens is you learn X and Y, will it have been worth it?
And, you know, you mentioned at the beginning of that your immigration story, you know, which is different than a lot of the stories that we're hearing about in the headlines right now. But I just wonder what you see when you read those stories.
Well, first, I know how easy I had it compared to some people who come to this country. At the same time, I know what America represents, whatever your reason for coming or whatever the precipitant is. I also know people don't leave their homes joyfully, usually. You know, yes, they see the opportunity. They want to cater to their family or earn money so they can send it home to their family. But it's really hard to leave home. I have a chapter in the book, The Education of an Idealist, called The Golden Door. It refers to a line that people, I think, are not familiar with, or at least I wasn't. It's a line from the Statue of Liberty. Like, we know about the give me your huddled masses and all of that. Now that's suddenly become a controversial sort of poem. But the beautiful line that I take the chapter title from is, I will hold my torch beside the golden door. And the idea is that people who are coming to America are passing through this golden door, you know, to this land of promise. And, you know, I hope that that's the country that we become again. All of us are either immigrants, kids of immigrants, grandkids of immigrants. Mm-hmm. So the idea that we would get in and then slam the door on others is just, it's so lacking in empathy. And to me, the golden rule is how I get my ethics, I guess, which is just do unto others as you'd have done unto you. How would, if you and your loved ones were facing such desperate straits, how would you want others to behave? You know, you can't just open sesame and let it. You have to have a process. You know, these things have to be adjudicated. But the generosity and the embrace of our strength as a nation of immigrants seems to have shriveled up in places. And so I really hope we can reclaim that.
You know, this is a broad question, but one I'd like to ask you because I think you might have an interesting perspective on. You were an insider in the Obama administration. Looking at the Trump administration, of course, you are an outsider. A lot of what we're seeing currently right now with interaction with foreign leaders, which of course is something you did constantly as a UN ambassador. I mean, is there a training? I mean, is there a, like, these are the okay things to say and these are the not okay things to say? Or is it very gray?
It's I write about that a little bit in the book because I'm the outsider, as you say, who comes in. So I have the sharpened senses of a newcomer, and suddenly I'm hearing all this crazy bureaucratic speak that doesn't make any sense to me initially, but also learning those procedures. In the case of Obama, he was learning, for example, when he won the election in November of 2008, he had to learn how to salute for the first time. Mm-hmm. And he and the rest of us who were going in with him had to be briefed on the different levels of classification.
Right.
And so you do get, like, even at that level for him, right, because he's talking to foreign leaders, you get, I don't want to call it a tutorial, but you get an exposure to the logic of the system that you are, as he likes to say, just a caretaker. You know, you're just passing through, mm-hmm. writing your paragraph of history. And so you learn how things have been done. I can't imagine any president got in history really, well, actually maybe at the founding. I've been going back lately and looking at the specter of foreign interference, mm-hmm. which of course really haunted the founders because they were coming out of a revolutionary war against the United Kingdom and were concerned that there were still British spies who were here and it all felt very fragile. So back then, actually, they probably were thinking this way. But it's been probably a couple hundred years before any president had to be told that you don't solicit foreign interference, you know, in your own country for your own personal benefit. So I think that tutorial probably has not been given at all.
Ambassador Samantha Power, her new book is The Education of an Idealist. Ambassador, thank you so much again.
Great to be here.
And that about does it for this Texas Standard special, looking back at some of the books we've covered this past year. We hope it sparked your imagination a bit as you work on those shopping lists and check them out twice. As always, you can keep up with the news at texasstandard.org and keep in touch with us on social media. Just look for, you know, the words Texas Standard. I'm David Brown, and from all of us here at The Standard, thanks so much for listening.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit texaspublicmedianetwork.com.